Welcome to the Institute of Economic Affairs In Conversation vidcast with me, Sai Kamal. During these discussions, we have conversations with a number of people where we're joined by academics, commentators and experts to discuss the pertinent issues and latest research. Now, we've seen that the clash between government and the trade unions over the reopening of schools has reminded many that the Conservative schools revolution remains unfinished. Education, education, education was how Tony Blair set out his priorities for office as Labour campaigned to put classrooms at the top of the political agenda. That was followed by David Cameron in 2010, and he said that education reform was high on the agenda. Michael Gove had ambitious plans to reshape the state education sector, and some of those reforms became quite controversial. What happened after Gove was moved from education? We saw Gavin Williamson hitting the headlines for his mantra, further education, further education, further education, and his plans to ditch the 50% university target. But what does he have planned for schools? And what should we make of the fact that the major academy chains back the government's plans to reopen schools in opposition to the teachers' unions? Well, I'm joined today by Dr. Steve Davis, Head of Education at the Institute of Economic Affairs, and Professor James Tooley, Pro Vice Chancellor of the University of Buckingham, to discuss the wider subject of education. We see 9 million adults in the UK are functionally literate. One in four British five-year-olds struggle with a basic vocab. What do you think of attempts by successive governments, albeit with antithetical approaches, to reform the education sector? Why don't we start with you, Steve? What do you make of recent reforms or reforms in the recent years? And why do you think the Conservatives' initial energy on education reform appears to have petered out?
Well, I'm not so sure, to take up a point that you made, Syed, that there is as much of an antithesis between the two parties as you might imagine, actually. I think actually that if you're at the sharp end of the educational system as a lecturer or a teacher, the news that there's more radical reform on the way will actually make your heart sink. Because what this typically means is top-down, highly complicated changes to your everyday working conditions. And when I say that the two parties have a similar approach, what I mean is that in both cases, what you have is the idea that what we need is a national education plan. What the two parties disagree about is precisely the details of that plan. But the commonality is the idea that there's some kind of need for a plan driven from the centre by the Department for Education, which should be rolled out through some kind of set of measures, targets, goals, this kind of thing. And I think that's the fundamental weakness. The problem is this idea. Well, two ideas, really. One, the idea that the whole function and purpose of the education system is basically to meet an economic need, a specific economic skills need. And secondly, that the best way to do this is through control by central government. And I think that those are two fundamentally mistaken ways of thinking about this whole question. So it's not surprising that I think the practical payoff from reforms has been just, well, mixed. I think some good things, but some bad things, but not the kind of complete transformation in the quality of education for most people that the politicians, to be fair to them, are looking for.
And James, what are your views on recent reforms or reforms in recent years in the education sector?
I think I'd go along with what Steve is saying quite a bit in terms of, is there a difference? John Major famously responded to Tony Blair. Remember Tony Blair, education, education, education. John Major famously responded and said that his priorities were the same, but in a different order. And I think that really sums it up in a way. I mean, where are we? We're 150 years exactly, aren't we, since the 1870 Forster Act, which really started, if you like, state education, government education in England and Wales. And what you've got to remember is before that act came in, there was a thriving market in low-cost education, in church schools, what were called the public schools, where even then only a very small amount of state funding. So, you know, since then, 150 years later, we have a system where government is fully in charge. And actually, another key date for me was 1988. It could have gone different ways. 1988, the Education Reform Act under Margaret Thatcher's government, it could have gone different ways. She was trying to impose or bring in a sort of market in education, a quasi-market within state education. And the more she or her people tried to liberate the market, the more people, other people try to come in and bring in ways of controlling that market. So there was this, you know, the Conservatives back in 1988, there were real problems there. They wanted to liberalize, but at the same time, they wanted to control. So on the one hand, you had per capita funding, which was a sort of voucher system. You know, you had money funding kids within schools. And then to make sure that didn't get too out of control, you had the national curriculum coming in, which was Margaret Thatcher's way of controlling in a way. You had local management of schools, LMS was called then. You had national testing. And that really, as Steve indicated, you know, playing around with those two aspects of it has been what different governments have done more or less in many similar ways. Michael Gove brought in free schools, following on from Tony Blair's bringing in academies, which really replaced the grant-maintained schools of the 93 Act. Playing around, not really actually moving towards educational freedom, to moving towards what can be the educational, the free market in education. So toying with the edges, I don't think either of us are particularly impressed by that.
No.
Okay, so we start off with some consensus on that. Why don't we bring ourselves up to date? I mentioned earlier the clash between government and trade unions over reopening schools. You see private schools fighting tooth and nail to reopen, with some developing their own track and trace apps. Now, James, you've done a lot of work on, first of all, private schools for the poor in many developing countries, and you've also looked at the idea of affordable private schools. Do you think what this clash that we're seeing at the moment, does that strengthen the case for more private schools or for the private school sector?
Yeah, most certainly. And you know, full disclosure, I'm the chairman of a low-cost private school that we started up in the north of England, in Durham. And we were the very first school of any sort to fully reopen. We fully reopened 2 or 3 weeks ago. I think as soon as there was any suggestion we might reopen, we reopened and were fully reopened. We're very small, so it was easier to do it. But nonetheless, the principle was, as a private school, you want to get going. You know, you want to get going because your children need it, your teachers are eager. And as a private school, there are obviously the incentive of school fees too. I think it's utterly appalling, really, in the state sector that there's this dragging of feet from the teacher unions and others not to open. And it's very good for a school like ours up north, and it would be very good for other private schools. So I think it's appalling what's happening. But it's great that the private sector, in some parts at least, is responding positively and showing what we can do. They're afraid in many ways of their insurance and so on, but they are trying to open.
And Steve, do you see this clash as helping the case for the private sector or make any difference on that debate?
Well, yes, I do. In as much as one of the sort of common elements in public policy that James described there earlier on is the idea that the kind of education that should be provided is the one that an elite thinks people ought to get, basically, rather than one that reflects the desires and wishes of parents and, or even to some degree, some of the pupils themselves. And I think you can see this playing out here in the whole question of whether or not to reopen schools after the initial onset of the pandemic, because some parents, obviously, do not want their children to go back to school. They're very concerned about the health risks, which is fair enough. And I do think that in the current context, you should say that, well, if you do want to keep your child off school, you know, that's up to you. You won't suffer the kind of normal penalty that you would normally do for it. But many other parents do want to have their children back at school for all sorts of reasons, in terms of the child's education, its social development, all that kind of thing. And as James says, both for reasons of incentives, but also in terms of responding to customers, basically, the private sector is more keen to do this. Now, if we had a system that was run on that basis, then some parents would still keep their children off school without a penalty. Other parents who were prepared to, you know, thought the risk was manageable and controllable, would send their children back to school. Both people would be happy. As it is at the moment, a significant number of people are not happy. And what I think this shows is that the system we have is one that's prone to what the economists call producer capture, where the institutions are run in the interests of the staff who provide the service, the teachers and the educational bureaucrats, not what you might call the customers, i.e. parents or even in some sense students.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there, Steve. And you did ask Saeed about my work in overseas private schools for the poor, and there's an enormous problem because governments have closed all the schools in Nigeria, in Kenya, in India, and all of these low cost entrepreneurs whose parents typically, as Stephen was indicating. Many parents want their children to come back to school. They're not allowed to go back to school. And these schools, as businesses, are closing now, all because the government and the teacher unions and whatever don't want any schools to open. It's a terrible thing that's happening at the moment. I'm getting emails many days sort of pointing to the terrible things that are happening in poor parts of Africa and South Asia and it's very disturbing to read.
Now, James, if, sticking with you, you know, when you read some of your works, such as A Beautiful Tree and other publications that you've written about the private sector, and particularly a private sector providing education for the poor or low-cost private schooling, people are quite often asked the question about, well, that's all very well in those countries, but what about over here? What if we did have a free market in education in the UK? Would we still need a government to provide a safety net, and would that be really to most people, or how many people would it be? And also, how do we in practice transition from the model we have now to a more private model?
Yeah, I've just finished a book actually on this theme, which is the Independent Institute in America's publishing in November. They've come up with an odd title, Really Good Schools, but nonetheless, it's actually on precisely these things. It's taking the work I've done in developing countries and saying, could this be applicable to America and Britain? And I think, you know, just so three quick points about it. One is, typically, people like us say, okay, so let's move towards a market. This was the 1988 idea, as I said, move towards a market. So let's bring in reforms. Let's bring in reforms like educational vouchers, charter schools, free schools, academies, and so on. And what I'm saying in this book is no, that way doesn't really, it's on a hiding to nowhere, really. Doesn't lead to a proper market, and in any case, the vested interests like the teacher unions and so on will either thwart it, stop it, or distort it. And so that's not the route to go. That's school choice with capital S and capital C, I say. Much better to go the just do it route, school choice with a little S and a little C, just do it, create private sector alternatives. I've started in a small way up north, but what I've seen in Nigeria, India, all these other countries is en masse, people are rejecting the state sector. And so now you have 70, 80% of children in poor parts of Africa, across the board, 70, 80%, and India, and Pakistan, and Bangladesh, going to private schools. I don't see why you couldn't have a similar revolution here, starting in a small way, moving towards this. And so slowly, the state, what's that Marxist phrase, withers away in education, not is pushed out. Now, I think I will see this in my lifetime, but that's if I live, 30 years more rather than, I think I will see it happen. But in terms of a safety net, your final point, Saeed, the safety net at most should be the safety net, same safety net that we have in terms of food and clothing and housing, not providing state food stores, state housing typically, or state clothing stores, but providing money to people who need money to access the otherwise private system. That's my vision. I've been writing about it for years. I've seen it now in developing countries. I know it happened historically before 1870. I think we could move to something like that here now.
Steve, would you agree? Have we moved to tried to move towards a free market utopia? There was a government that was prepared to be radical enough to let the private sector in and not to squeeze it out. And would you agree that was a way that you achieved that? And what about the safety net argument?
3 points, really. First of all, I agree completely with James about this kind of top-down technocratic approach, which is not just education, by the way. This idea that you somehow create markets by some kind of bureaucratic legerdemain or legislative enactment, I think is a huge blind alley if you are a believer in classical liberal ideals. It's a kind of form of technocratic managerialism that I think is deeply destructive. Now, in terms of things like safety and so on, I, in this as in other ways, take the John Stuart Mill view. And Mill's position was that the state should require people to have their children educated, because he made the point that there will always be a minority of parents who are either incompetent or irresponsible. And if they fail to get their children educated, the cost for the child is considerable and probably lifelong. So it's fair enough that the state should use its power to make it compulsory for parents to have their children educated up to a certain standard. But, he went on to argue, the state should not in any way provide that service. His great line is that a state education system is a great device for trying to make everyone alike. That's from On Liberty. But he repeats that line in a number of his other writings. And exactly as James says, his argument was that in cases where the poor were unable to afford the kind of education, which he thought would not be likely, but in the case it did happen, the state should basically give them the funds so that they could do it rather than providing it themselves. So I think that's how the safety net should take it. What I would add to James's point, though, is that I think we should not be hung up on the idea that this means private schools, because I think it's one thing, we should require that parents have their children educated up to a certain level, which you can ascertain by compulsory public examinations or tests. But it doesn't follow that this has to be done through the conventional institution and methodology of a school, as we understand that term today. I'm actually perhaps a bit more radical than James on this. I'm a John Holt, Ivan Illich, Paul Goodman kind of guy myself. I think that you can have means of delivering education which are different from the traditional conventional school, the Prussian school, I would say. Now, in some poor parts of the world, you probably still do have to have a kind of school where you have desks in a room, because that's the cheapest and most effective way of delivering the education, given the limitations of being in a poor society. But I think in a wealthy society, as I think we're beginning to discover during this pandemic, there are lots and lots of other ways of delivering education, which could be vastly more effective. And a friend of mine, Greg Remke, has been doing quite a lot of work about this in the States with homeschooled children. And he has explained to me and other people that really homeschooling is no longer the right word for it. It's home-centered education, because there are so many parents engaged in homeschooling now in the United States that you have this whole array of institutions that do things like offering short, intense, full immersion courses to homeschool children for, like, say, a month at a time, which is actually a much more effective way of teaching a subject than what we do in a school, where you get taught 2 hours a week each week and typically spend half of each class trying to go over the work you did the previous week. So I think that if we follow the kind of Mill line and do go for a radical thing, just let people do it rather than trying to impose market reforms, then you should also be prepared to have an enormous variety of institutional means and methods for delivering what I think we all want, which is empowering education for everybody.
Steve, you'll be pleased to know you can't out-radicalize me on this. I've been writing about this for many years, that actually, you know, what I was talking about earlier was the schools that we get in developing countries, and as you say, but the evolution of education is likely to encompass many different ways of delivery, and absolutely agree with you that it can be totally within civil society, in religious organizations, within churches, in pubs or reading rooms or through the internet. But it's also possible that schools or the similar will emerge. They certainly emerged. That was the market that emerged prior to 1870. That was a genuine spontaneous order, and it was schools. I don't know what the genuine spontaneous order would be like now. But it could be. There could be some sense, particularly until a certain age. I always think probably age 10 or 11. There's a certain sense in probably having something a bit like schools. But after that, free for all. But we don't know. And that's the beauty of this. We don't know what it's going to be like. But it could be very exciting, whatever comes from. But, I'm on your side there, Steve, too. You know, I'm as impressed by Ivan Illich as the next man or woman.
Well, it's great to see competition alive and see two of you be out-compete each other to be Now, Steve, you said something very interesting there. You both agree on a variety of different ways of providing education. You know, anyone who's read the theories on how people, how students learn or how people learn, there are different types of learning, and we still tend to have a very much a sort of Victorian method of learning. Teacher or lecturer at the front of the classroom, people assembled in desks. We may have moved away from rows now, and we may have different ways, but we've essentially got the same model. But what's interesting, you also spoke about public exams. Does that not imply perhaps a curriculum or an agreed curriculum? And what role does government have to play in that?
I think that to go back to the point James sort of hinted at, I think you need to make a distinction between elementary education and post-elementary. Now, the elementary education is what you might call a list of minimal skills or capacities that you want everyone in a society who is actually capable of acquiring them to have, which means basic numeracy, literacy, and the ability to write, which are the skills which, as you indicated at the start, Syed, the current system is failing to supply. I mean, the absolute scandal of the system we have in this country now is that levels of adult literacy are worse than they were before World War I, which is simply staggering when you think about what has happened in the interim. And so I think that is where very simple, straightforward tests can be provided on a kind of uniform basis. I mean, they don't have to be done by government. You might have some body that was chartered to it, which would be very easy to do to make sure that people had reached a certain kind of minimal level of attainment. After that, I wouldn't at all be keen on the idea of having government-provided examinations. I think that the model of things like the Sitting and Guilds Institute is the kind of way to go. Private sector bodies, which compete with each other and which also provide means of assessing levels of attainment and capacity in any number of different subject areas, skill areas, and the like. That would also have obvious implications for the way higher education is run. I think an awful lot of what goes on in higher education now is basically certification by higher education institutions to try and make people more attractive to employers through giving a signal. And it seems to me that there are all sorts of ways of doing that, which is a lot cheaper than having somebody spend 3 years in higher education. Not that I'm against people being in higher education. I think it's potentially very rewarding, but I think the way it's delivered at the moment is actually not oriented towards the most productive use of those 3 years.
So 3 years, but of course at Buckingham we have 2 year degrees, so we have a slight innovation there. No, I sort of agree with the latter part of what Steve was saying there, but the beginning part, and going back to his discussion of John Stuart Mill. No, this is where we part company. I definitely don't see the need for government compulsion in terms of schooling. I think from my experience around the world, you know, amongst some of the poorest communities, most deprived communities, education is seen as something that parents want for their children, whatever they can do. It's as natural as feeding and clothing your child to want them to be educated. Government compulsion gets in the way. And of course, if you start government compelling you to do something, then government will have to give you a structure for it. And then you run into the problems of having a government curriculum and all the rest of it. So I don't see the need for that. I like what you said about the City and Guilds. I'm always very impressed by two other areas of private sector involvement in assessment. One is the music exams. You know, the Royal Schools of Music, they have 8 grades plus a foundation year. You can take them whenever you're ready. You don't have to, you know, you can take grade 5 whether you're 5, 15 or 55. You don't have to have done grade 4 first. It's a very flexible, very interesting way. It's also in terms of martial arts, judo, apparently, I'm not an expert, apparently it's a similar similar 7 or 8 belts that you have in music. These are very good ways of doing things. They're very proximate measures of your real human capital. They're not about signaling, they're about real human capital. And I think the private sector is great. International baccalaureate is another interesting idea that, you know, came into the, out of the private sector, and is another sort of form of assessment that's, that illustrates your point, I think, Stephen, well.
Steve, I wonder whether I could come back on a point you made about elementary education or basic education, because at the moment you will see, you know, as we have this debate about schools reopening, the government is now saying that it wants to put a focus on English and maths when schools do eventually return. Is that wise from your point of view?
I think that's ridiculously top-down and trying to have a one-size-fits-all policy. The thing is, some children will have not gone backwards at all in terms of their attainments in those areas. Others will do. But the idea that you should say, oh, everyone is going to somehow have remedial English and remedial maths universally across the board is, strikes me as just simply preposterous. That's a way to make at least half, probably more, of the student, pupil population really miserable and irritated, and definitely not create a good learning environment for the ones who do need it. Why not allow individual teachers and schools to decide which of their pupils need the remedial care, if any? And so this is an example of what I think is the fundamental problem. It used to be famously said that in the French education system, the education minister could look at his watch and know from the day of the week in his watch exactly what every school child in France was reading at that moment. Well, it seems to me that that's the kind of ambition that our own bureaucrats in the DfE want to have. And this is just an example of that whole approach.
James, I assume you'll agree with that, and you won't want to be out-radicalised here. So let me move on very quickly, which is, you've spoken about your own experience. You've looked at schools sort of poor in slums, parents voting with their feet, saving their bit of money. What lessons, and you've started your own school in the UK here, which lessons or which models from around the world do you think the UK could realistically adopt?
I mean, for me, it's the model that I see in these countries, isn't it? It's the model I see of parents and, the poorest parents, but just let's say parents. Parents are saying, we want control of our children's education. They are saying the government schools are not good enough. But also they're saying, we want the schools to be accountable to us. And so we are prepared to spend small amounts of money on school fees, and private entrepreneurs come in and are willing to provide what parents want. And then you've got some entrepreneurs willing to service the schools in terms of providing teacher training or curriculum development and so on and so forth. So there you've got that word ecosystem, isn't it? You've got an ecosystem, a spontaneous order, I like to describe it, of as parents, children, parents, entrepreneurs, teachers, educators, all coming together and providing a system. The beautiful thing is, the research shows the system is better than that provided by government. It's the choice of parents. It provides better value for money. It's fair to girls. What's there not to, and it's affordable. It meets the affordability. In the slums, you'll find these schools are affordable by those on poverty lines. So to me, what I found there shows a spontaneous order of education that has emerged, and I believe we can replicate that here. It's going to take time. It will require people to come in as entrepreneurs and so on to meet the needs. It will require us to go against, 150 years of state education, in a sense, being immersed in an idea that only the state can provide this, that it is something that the state should provide. So it's really it's the principles.
When you look at the private education, you've come in with a low-cost school. Most of private education in this country is unaffordable for the masses. But despite that, you see some private schools appear to be in trouble. There's all sorts of pressures being put on them. Are they really acting as charities? Even though they're charitable, they get tax breaks. Governments are worried about some of those tax breaks. How do you view the existing private sector in this country?
I'm not that excited by it, really, But I am excited by some part of the private sector, which is bringing fees down slightly. I'm excited by I mean, Steve mentioned homeschooling earlier, that, you know, you can get a private sector which is like a hybrid homeschooling and school model that's emerging. Seeing that in places, and I'm excited, obviously, by the idea of lower cost private schooling, which can cater to many more parents. But no, I've spoken at HMI conferences and sort of said, what the hell are you doing? Why are you pricing yourself out of the market? Do you really need AstroTurf, you know, football pitches and Olympic sized swimming pools and buildings that are fit for a duke? You know, I don't think you do. And parents increasingly are following that. Yeah, you're right. The private sector has completely outpriced itself from most people. And it wasn't, you know, even 15 years ago, you know, you could get professionals like us could afford private education. I don't think any of us could afford private education for our kids now.
Could I just come in there, Sid? I think I can also explain why and how that has happened, which is that the private sector in this country, well, two things about it. One is, I actually would quite favour them losing their charitable status. Because that would force them to actually think of themselves as profit-making businesses, which would change their whole mindset, I think. But also, I think what happened is this. As James says, in the 60s, up to about the early to mid-70s, the private sector was, with a couple of obvious exceptions, pretty much affordable to people of a middle-class income, and even below that. What they then did was they then reinvented themselves as essentially devices for gaming the meritocratic system. And that is what has led to this huge escalation in costs and provision, because what essentially you're doing is you're competing to get your students into what is ultimately a finite pool of people who win the meritocratic lottery. And therefore, there's an arms race effect, because it takes more and more money, more and more effort, more and more capital investment to try and be sure that the students who have paid these very high fees to you have got into, like I say, the winning tickets in the meritocratic lottery. And so it's the reason why we have a private sector of the kind we do, rather than the kind of that James is talking about in poorer countries, is because it's only providing a very specific kind of educational product, which is basically success in the meritocratic system. And which is what I dislike intensely for all sorts of reasons. But that's what it does. And the logic of that is to then create an arms race effect, which leads to constantly escalating prices. They need to think about a different business model and see themselves as being engaged in a different kind of business, basically.
Or perhaps not them, but a new.
Exactly. Private. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, yes.
It sounds rather like our criticism of big business. They become quite comfortable and bloated, got a comfortable relationship with the government, and maybe they need to be challenged a bit more. Now, look, as we've obviously covered a number of issues in this discussion. So as we look to sum up, well, maybe I could start with you, Steve. You know, we have no crystal ball, but you've spoken and you've written about how pandemics have sometimes exacerbated already existing trends. You talked about the impact on economies and attitudes as well. How do you think this the crisis would have changed attitudes towards towards state education, if at all? And does it make reform more or less likely?
I think, well, what kind of reform? You see, if it makes it more likely that the politicians will think, oh, we need to have another go at reforming things, then my heart will sink, basically, because I don't see that as a way forward. If, on the other hand, it makes people, as parents, think there's something fundamentally wrong with the way my child is being educated and we need to do something about it, that would be a much better thing, in my view. And I think, I'm not sure, I don't know how people will react to this. I do think quite a lot of parents are going to begin to wonder what it is their child has been doing at school a lot of the time when they realize how much they've been able to do at home by themselves. So it could well lead to quite a bit of discontent going forward with the way that schooling has been working. But I wouldn't be prepared to predict that. I honestly have no idea how people are generally going to respond to the experience they've had over the last few months.
James, I wonder if I can ask you the same question, ask you to look into the crystal ball. How do you think the current coronavirus crisis has affected or will affect attitudes towards state education and private education?
Yeah, I think I'm with Steve here. It's too early to say, you know, as a in some ways. But there have been two different sorts of experiences, haven't there, really? So we've heard about, you know, middle class colleagues and so on, who are, can actually be said perhaps having quite a ball, you know, having their children at home, self-educating them, homeschooling them, getting stuff from the school but supplementing it in their own ways. And, you know, it has been quite successful. And funnily enough, I told you I've got a book being published in America. My editor has come in with lots of positive comments. You know, why don't you put this in about COVID-19? How positive it's all been for your argument, because, you know, everyone's seeing how wonderful education, you know, at home outside of state schools is. But of course, that's only half or probably a very smaller fraction of the story, that actually for many kids, it's been a dismal experience. You know, they've been abandoned by their schools and nothing much has replaced it. Now, you know, which is the stronger thing that's happening? I don't know. Will it have an impact on how parents are seeing schooling? It probably will. I mean, we've had a lot of parents talking about that's just the specifics of the curriculum, aren't they? I didn't realize my kids were being taught this in geography or history or whatever, very specific things that are disturbing them. But my hope about the whole crisis is the whole crisis will be over soon, and will, just as people didn't mention the so-called Spanish flu a year or two after it was over, we won't talk about COVID-19 ever again in our lives, and we'll be back to normal, and this will be an academic discussion. That's my hope. Let's see what happens. I don't know. But whatever will happen, I believe the spontaneous order in education, which I'm seeing around the world welling up, it can emerge here, and maybe this will help, maybe it won't, but it will emerge in due course.
Well, Professor James Tooley, Dr. Steve Davis, thank you very much for joining us today. Can I thank the viewers and listeners for watching and listening? For more details of all our online content and to stay updated on our activity, please visit our website, ia.org.uk. Check out our YouTube channel, IA London. Listen to our podcasts on Podbean. And do think about subscribing to our daily newsletter, IA Daily. And to help us keep providing free content during these tough times, please do consider making a contribution, no matter how modest, by donating online at ia.org.uk. Once again, thank you very much for watching or listening today, and we hope that you'll be able to join us again soon. Thank you.